there. Hi, everybody. Welcome. Thank you so much. Mustafa Barghouti, this is such an unspeakable honor to have you as my opening act. I do not deserve it, and your words were far too kind. This is, I think, the most emotional event I've ever done. I give speeches once in a while. But I've never had quite this feeling before, this feeling of overwhelming emotion. I want to thank the Edward Said Orchestra, the musicians who performed so beautifully, and brought... and who brought the spirit of the great Edward Said into the room with us. That truly is an opening act. I also want to thank my friend and publisher, Yael Lair, publisher of Andalus, a supporter of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And we have figured out, along with the wonderful Omar Barghouti and the Boycott National Committee, how to do this very, very unconventional book tour in support, cooperation, collaboration with the BDS call. It's been a learning experience. And one of the things that we have learned is that, you know, one of the criticisms of this strategy, of applying the boycott strategy, is that it cuts off communication. Don't we all want to communicate more? And should we all communicate more if there's to be peace and justice in this world? Let me tell you, when you actually try to put BDS into practice in your life, when you try to figure out how to write and publish books and make culture and do business while supporting this call, you have to communicate all the time. We have built new networks. We have made many, many new friends. We have had many, many meetings. We have chatted incessantly across all kinds of religious, ethnic, national boundaries. So this is most certainly not cutting off communication. It is forging new forms of communication, because that's what happens when you build movements. And you know, one of the things that I can tell you, as somebody who actually the first movement that I was a part of as a university student was the movement against South African apartheid. We occupied the office of the president of the University of Toronto, demanding divestment from South African businesses of our university's investment plan. And the people who were really at the forefront of that movement continue to be at the forefront of all kinds of movements. It was a training ground. It built relationships. So after the struggle against apartheid was won, the people who were part of that movement, those networks that were forged, became actually the infrastructure of the movement calling for debt jubilee around the world, taking on the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and activist infrastructure was laid down. And what we see in this movement is that it is that many of the people who were part of that struggle continue to be involved in politics and are part of this struggle today. I meant to look at my watch to make sure I didn't go over. We'll see how that goes. I guess I wanted to start by letting you in on a little secret. There is a debate among Jews. I used to say the Jewish community, but then I got excommunicated. So there is a debate among Jews. I'm a Jew, by the way. About whether the lesson of the Holocaust should be never again to anyone or never again to us. That's what it pretty much boils down to. And there are a lot of people that believe that the lesson of the Holocaust was never again to us, never again to the Jews. And because we suffered this tremendous crime against humanity, we have the right to do whatever it takes to keep ourselves safe. In fact, we even think we get a kind of get one genocide free card out of this. You know, scratch the surface and you'll get there. You'll get there. And there is another strain in the Jewish tradition that said that the lesson of the Holocaust was never again to anyone. And that it is precisely because of what we experienced as Jews, that we must denounce racism, denounce systems of segregation wherever they crop up, even especially when they crop up amongst our own. And I'm proud to put myself and thank my parents for this in that second tradition, which is why I'm proud to join you here tonight. I know this is sort of a weird place to start, but I'm going to start in Geneva. I was in Geneva recently for a conference called the Durban Review Conference. It took place at the end of April. In the press, particularly in the Israeli and American press, it was not referred to by its proper name, the Durban Review Conference. It was called Durban 2, aka Hate Fest. Now, for those of you who follow this, the Durban Review Conference, which was a follow-up to the 2001 World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, was the subject of an extraordinary propaganda campaign to equate the word Durban with the word hate fest, anti-Semitic hate fest. And this word came up all the time to delegitimize the conference. And there are a whole series of groups that devoted themselves to this project. In Israel, the group that was really at the forefront of this was NGO Monitor, associated with the Jerusalem Center, headed by Gerald Steinberg. There was also UN Watch in Geneva, Eye on the UN. There's in fact a whole sort of infrastructure of groups that were born after the first Durban conference in order to prevent a follow-up to that conference. And as the event drew near in April, what you saw is almost every major Zionist organization around the world lining up to call for governments to boycott the Durban Review Conference. Israel boycotted the conference, so did Canada. There was a thought that the new administration of Barack Obama would break with Bush's policy and attend this anti-racism conference, that it would be extraordinarily important symbolically as the first African-American president for him to do that. And they did re-engage a little bit with the negotiations, but ultimately the U.S. did boycott. And once they decided to boycott, many other countries pulled out very, very quickly. Italy, Germany, the Netherlands. We heard a lot of things about the claims that were made about this conference that actually were not true. The declaration, the official declaration that came out of the conference in 2001, it actually didn't say Israel is a racist state. The only thing it did, it was extremely mild, extremely banal. It said that we recognize the plight of the Palestinian people, but we encourage speedy peace negotiations. Everybody has a right to security. So there was this chasm between what people thought this conference was and what actually happened, what was on paper. So what I've been researching and looking into, and I've just written a long piece about this, it hasn't come out yet, but it'll come out in a little while, was trying to understand why this was such a priority for the state of Israel. You know, Netanyahu wrote thank you notes to all 10 countries that boycotted the Durban Review Conference. Why was it such a priority of the Israeli state? And I want to say, first of all, that there were anti-Semitic incidents that took place in Durban in 2001. Absolutely. There were cartoons that were circulated by some NGOs that had sort of Der Stürmer-style cartoons of hook-nosed Jews and all of this. It was bad. It was a very, very marginal part of the conference. You don't derail an entire UN process because some idiots passed out anti-Semitic cartoons. That would be like derailing the Kyoto Protocol because, you know, something extreme happened on the margins of one of the conferences. So what was really at the root of this successful campaign to totally delegitimize a global discussion? Now, keep in mind, the first Durban conference was a big deal. And, you know, there were 16 heads of state that traveled. traveled to Durban. There were, I think, 48 ministers, or foreign ministers, who traveled to Durban. Fidel Castro went, Arafat went. Now, one of the reasons why people don't really remember what happened and what was significant about that first Durban conference, and why it is so easy to spread misinformation about it and claim that things happened that didn't happen, is because that conference ended on September the 9th, 2001. So there were 2 days when the truth could have seeped into the culture, after which point, you know, I write a lot about shock in my work, after which point the discussion was decisively changed to the endless war on terror. So anything could be claimed about this conference. As I looked into this, what I found was that the reason why there is such a zealous opposition to the Durban process is because the birth of the BDS movement, of the BDS campaign, of equating the practices of the Israeli state with the practices of apartheid South Africa, that was really first fully articulated in Durban in 2001 at the NGO forum. If you look at the NGO declaration, it says that Israel is practicing a form of apartheid, and it calls for the use of precisely these tactics in order to isolate Israel and force it to comply with international law. And so, as all of you know who are part of the boycott committee, the attempt to stop this campaign is very, very strong. But in a lot of the writing about and against this movement that we are part of here tonight, traces the origin back to Durban 2001. And so what we see is a tremendous fear of the Palestinian cause becoming the next South Africa, becoming the next big global civil society movement. And there's a history to this too, because there were two anti-racism conferences before the UN anti-racism conferences, before the one in 2001. The most recent one was in 1983. Both of those conferences focused on South African apartheid. And they were very, very important gathering places. So in some of the writing that I've been seeing by people like Erwin Kotler, who is our former justice minister in Canada, they talk about the South Africa strategy having been born, the South Africa strategy as it relates to Israel, having been born in South Africa, in Durban, because there is such a particular resonance, as many of you know, among South Africans, precisely because they know apartheid when they see it. And they have seen it here, and they've named it here, and we're naming it back in 2001, only 7 years after their own first free elections. Now, one of the things that we hear, that we heard a lot, and this it relates a lot to this whole discussion of apartheid in Israel, is this claim that, yes, okay, there are separate roads, there are special passes, there's this whole system, but that doesn't have to do with racism. That has to do with a dispute over geography and land, and it has no place within a discussion of racism. So yeah, we accept that those white Afrikaners in Africa were racist, but Jews can't be racist, and this is not about racism. And this is where what I think should properly be called the Durban consensus really comes into play, and why this idea of an international civil society broad-based movement on the South African model is such a threat. Because during that conference, a lot of very significant things happened. Arguably the most significant one was that all over the global south, but particularly in Africa, people refused this idea that they would just have a nice, easy conference about racism, where everybody would agree that it's bad and it's wrong, and they would sign, you know, well-meaning declarations. But most of all, they would just pat each other on the back for all the good things that they've done, like defeat apartheid in South Africa. That was what was supposed to happen in Durban. But what actually happened, and we would know this, I think, if it weren't for September 11th, was that racism was put in a historical context. And the consensus, what I'm calling the Durban consensus, was that there's no way to understand the particular form of racism that we have, which is white supremacy, which says that people with white skin are somehow better than people with darker skin, and the darker the skin, the worse it gets. This system can only properly be understood in the context of the history of colonialism. And in particular, the economic history of the need for two very profitable things. One, free labor. Two, free land. So contemporary racism, as opposed to just general suspicion of otherness and difference, contemporary racism needs to be understood as the theory that allowed European settlers to rationalize slavery on the one hand and land theft on the other. So in order to justify treating Africans as cattle, you had to have a theory that said that Africans were not fully human. You had to have a theory that justified that. So racism wasn't the end, it was the means. It was the means for this extraordinarily profitable proposition. Now, the early explorers in the Americas recognized that indigenous people all over the Americas had agriculture, sophisticated architecture. This is in all the journals, including in North America, not just Aztecs. But as the imperative was built to be able to take land and not pay for it, to claim that it was owned by nobody, the same people, the same indigenous people who were recognized as having cultivated the land and built on the land, built sophisticated cities on the land, were suddenly only people who ranged over the land. And if they ranged over the land, then they didn't have property rights, according to people like John Locke. So once again, that was the story that was being told in Durban. Now, is it any wonder that that story is extraordinarily threatening to the most recent arrival to the settler state game, okay, that being Israel? So what you saw was a kind of a solidarity in Durban between the older settler states like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, who all boycotted, by the way, the second Durban conference, and Israel. So it wasn't just that they were acting on Israel's behalf, it's that there was a common purpose, a common cause being found in challenging this very threatening narrative around racism. The reason why it was threatening is that the demand in Durban was for reparations. It was for reparations for both slavery and colonialism. So racism was suddenly getting expensive. It wasn't just, you know, oh, we're all against it. There was a price tag attached. And there was a question being asked, wait a minute, who really owes who? You know, all these countries that have been cast as the debtors of the world, well, maybe they're the creditors of the world, if we recognize this as the first wave of colonialism. So, I think that should put perhaps this discussion into a little bit of context. And sometimes, you know, as I've looked at the Zionist response to this conversation, more and more I see all of these fears around a Islamist and a left alliance, right? But we also hear a discourse where everybody is being smeared as anti-colonial, the anti-colonial left, right? This we should see as a great compliment, by the way. And I think increasingly, what we're hearing more overtly from the more radical sectors of Israeli society is the idea that there's somehow some kind of discrimination going on against Israel when it is not allowed to be as racist as European settler states. Like somehow that's anti-Semitic if white European Jews can't do what non-Jewish Europeans were able to do 200 years earlier. This is not a definition that any of us should embrace or accept. BDS. You know, the column that was cited earlier, I tried to address a few of the arguments that come up as soon as you start advocating for South African style tactics to be used in the Palestinian context. I'm not going to go through all of them here. I think many of you may have read the column. I think it was sent around ahead of this talk. But I do want to address a couple more of them. One of them is this idea that this tactic will do more harm than good because it will alienate otherwise supportive Israelis. And that what we should be doing is being more constructive. Now, I don't think I need to spend too much time on that in Ramallah because people have been very, very constructive here for many, many years. But one point that I would just like to stress that I made in that piece is that this idea of constructive engagement as opposed to a BDS strategy, what we see in the past 3 years is that as Israeli violence has really escalated dramatically, thinking about the attacks on Lebanon in 2006, the most recent assault on Gaza, what we see is that in this period, not only hasn't Israel faced any kind of reprisal from its trading partners, but actually trade relations have been deepened quite dramatically in this period. And I think this is really important for us to keep in mind. You have new trade deals being signed. In 2007, Israel became the first non-Latin American country to sign a free trade deal with Mercosur, which is the Latin American trading bloc. In the first 9 months of 2008, Israeli exports to Canada, where I live, went up 45%. So it's a kind of a reward that we see for this escalating violence. We see a new trade deal with the European Union, which is set to double Israel's exports of processed foods, and so on. This is, when the attack on Gaza began, what you really saw was, I think, the cost of what happens when you truly have a feeling of impunity, total impunity on the part of the Israeli state. They started that criminal act knowing that they would not face economic sanctions. And in fact, they were quite right. In the first 7 days of wartime trading, so while Gaza is being pounded, the first 7 days of trading on the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, the flagship index actually went up by 10.7%. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. Actually, when states go into a war, they see their stocks plummet. But the opposite actually happened. Another objection that we hear to BDS is, Israel is not South Africa. Now, this is sort of a silly objection, as far as I'm concerned, because nobody's ever claimed that there's an absolute equivalency. But the reason why the United Nations codified what an apartheid state was in international law is because it understood that it was going to look different in any context. So the question is not, is Israel the same as South Africa? It is, do Israel's actions meet the international definition of what apartheid is? And if you look at those conditions, which include the transfer of people, which includes multiple tiers of law, official state segregation, then you see that yes, it does meet that definition, which is different than saying it is South Africa. No two states are the same, but that's not the question. That's a distraction. The real reason, and I think what we really can learn from the South African example, is that when you have a relatively small trade-dependent state, this is a tactic that can actually work. And, I'm not going to be spending a lot of time, I won't be spending time here today talking about the material in my book. I have a chapter on Israel and Palestine as a kind of a laboratory for the homeland security sector. But I do want to talk about that just in the context of economic pressure. Because what I argue in the Shock Doctrine is that part of the reason why there's so little interest in peace within Israel, we've got two reasons. One, the fact that it is possible to live a relatively normal, fun life in Israel. And the other is that Israeli companies are not feeling the pinch from war. And if you look at many, many different conflict zones, whether it's Ireland, whether it's Sri Lanka, when a society ultimately gets tired of war, it's because people say, I just want to live a normal life. I just want to live a normal life. And also because the business sector starts to put pressure on the government so that they can engage in normal trading. And because it is so very difficult to have a thriving economy in the context of war, you can have a thriving military economy, but a broader economy is very difficult to have in a conflict situation. Both of those issues are challenged by the explosion of the homeland security sector in Israel, which is of course intimately connected with the infrastructure of apartheid in the occupied territories, because these are the technologies, the surveillance cameras, the walls, that allow the biometric identification, all of it, which is all run by private companies. This, on the one hand, allows Israelis to live that so-called normal life even as the conflict rages, even as the occupation continues, even as peace and justice are denied. You can still have that bubble of normalcy. And in addition to that, you have a very large sector of the Israeli economy that is profiting directly from the homeland security sector. Not just in Israel, but because Israel is being treated like a live laboratory, okay? Because the occupied territories are really the laboratory and Palestinian people are the test market, okay, for these technologies, then that means that they can be exported. And they are being exported. And we see this, you know, very dramatically with the fact that the Israeli companies that have built the wall, the apartheid wall here, are going and selling their expertise to the U.S. government. You know, they call it the virtual fence. It's also a $2 billion project being built between the U.S. and Mexico, and also the U.S. and Canada. And it's a whole network of sensors and guard towers and electrified fences and so on. The $2 billion contract went to Boeing, but the main subcontractor was Elbit, which is one of the two main Israeli companies building the wall here. So it isn't just about the economy here in Israel. It's about saying, we know how to do this. Look at what a safe, normal bubble we have managed to create surrounded by a sea of enemies. Now, in this context, peace is a threat. Because if these companies can't claim that they are protecting Israelis from an endless, irrational enemy that they can never talk to, but yet they're still able to keep Israelis relatively safe, and actually they lose their market, okay? So one of the things that we're doing here with BDS is we're creating another pressure in the Israeli economy that actually does want peace. We're challenging, one, the idea of normalization, because, you know, when a film you really want to see isn't going to play in the Jerusalem Film Festival. You know, when a conference you wanted to go to isn't going to happen in Tel Aviv because people have decided that they're not going to have it there. That challenges such a central part of Israeli identity. But on the other hand, you're going to have more and more companies that are going to go to Israel. And this is what the Israeli government, this is what happened in the South African context. And they're going to say, what the South African businesses said in the 80s, finally, in the late 80s, look, you've got to make this stop. That's what they said to the de Klerk government. We can't take it anymore. We can't take this boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign. It's starting to hurt our bottom line. So there's already a huge part of the Israeli economy that's saying the opposite. It's actually saying we don't want peace. We want status quo. We want security, not peace. There has to be another section of the Israeli economy that says no, no. We need peace. We need peace to have a normal life. Everybody deserves that. But you can't have unilateral normalcy. It has to all happen at the same time, or we're losing one of the most important levers for peace. And this is what this non-violent movement is trying to do. Now, so many people have condemned Palestinians for using violence to support their cause. And it drives me crazy that those very same people are also against boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which is a non-violent means of achieving peace and justice. And if you push them a little further, what do they really want? Not much. Sign a petition, have a useless protest, but anything that's actually effective is going to get slammed. So, you know, the opposition that this movement is up against is really a measure of the fact that it is an effective strategy. When we get slammed for using words with power, like apartheid or ethnic cleansing, use human rights abuse, right? Use words that wash over us, not words that wake us up, right? So everything would be fine if we used words that barely registered and tactics that barely worked. That would be fine. But we're here to reject that. We want to use language that resonates and reaches people, and we want to use tactics that actually work. Now, I want to say a couple words about Barack Obama. You know, some of you have heard this. There's this apocryphal story out there. There's this apocryphal story out there about FDR. It's actually Eleanor Roosevelt, too. It's actually Harry Belafonte who tells this story. He said that Eleanor Roosevelt told him this story. Okay, so I'm telling you, maybe it didn't happen, okay? But this is Harry Belafonte's version of what Eleanor Roosevelt said to him. She said that when FDR would meet with civil rights leaders who would make demands that he didn't feel was politically possible at the time, you hear them at him and say, "That sounds like a great idea. I want to do it. Now get out there and make me do it. Create the conditions under which I can do it." Okay? Now, I don't really think Obama's FDR, but I can tell you this. He needs us to make him do it. Okay? He needs that mass movement, that global mass movement, putting pressure on him, because boy is he getting pressure from the other side. Okay? And he takes this tiny, tiny little tentative stand. No more settlements. Okay? No more settlements. Suddenly, this is, you know, a crazy progressive position. That's not a progressive position. How about no settlements, okay? We need to move the bar. We need to put really radical positions out there. How about a one-state solution? How about no settlements? Let's get out there and make a lot of noise. Build a mass movement for peace and justice in a way that is totally unapologetic. It doesn't cater to the racists. It doesn't apologize for itself, that knows that it is within the greatest traditions of anti-racism, whether they are in South Africa in the liberation struggle, or whether they are within the Jewish community and the fact that Jews have been part of struggles for social justice for so long, and I am sad that so many of my fellow Jews have forgotten that tradition. In closing, I don't think it's brave that I supported the BDS call in 2008, when Gaza was being attacked and children were dying. The call was made in 2005. I'm ashamed that it took me this long. I'm not being humble when I say that I'm sorry, that it was nothing but cowardice. It was nothing but cowardice. But I ask all of you out there who are on the fence to please join me.